Okay, run it down.
Can you feel the love?
La 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 la.
Can you feel the love? Ooh,
can you feel the love?
You can be here if you open up your eyes. But it's not so hard to find.
Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Meet Mr. Jonathan. Behind the wheel, he's got the feel. This dud is no dud. He's bad. He's mean. He's a loving machine. He's the height of fashion, the peak of passion. Sends gangsters crashing and women thrashing. Black shampoo. He's got the touch they love so much.
You tell Mr. Jonathan that I left. If he won't do me, nobody will.
Does Mr. Jonathan make house calls?
Hello, ladies. Artie taking good care of all of you?
Artie just didn't have the equipment you have.
He gives each pet a wash and set. Men can't get him off their backs. Women can't get him out of their hair.
Jonathan.
Hello, Mr. Jonathan.
This is our new receptionist. Do you like her?
Wonderful, wonderful.
God, she'll never drown.
Well, I told you to watch who you're in it to, too, Denda.
Hand me that thing. Hang him down. I'm going to give you the thrill of your lifetime.
Don't give him no sass, or he'll kick your ass. A woman entices. A chainsaw slices. He's mad. He's mean. He's a killing machine. Let him give you a black shampoo. Black shampoo.
A Graydon Clark production starring John Daniels and Tanya Boyd.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me in the salon is Rob St. Mary.
Do me a favor. Just take a little off the sides.
Also along for the ride this week is my old friend Leon Chase.
Hey, Mike. Exactly what kind of funny farm are you running here?
Funny farm? Just who do you think you are? I ought to call the police.
This week we're talking about my most favorite film in the whole world, Graydon Clark's Black Shampoo. Released in March 1976, the film tells the tale of Jonathan Knight, the hottest hairdresser on the Sunset Strip. He's a Lothario who doesn't know that true love sits at his receptionist's desk until his receptionist, Brenda, is taken away by the dastardly Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Wilson? I never heard of anybody by that name.
From there, Jonathan goes from a loving machine to a killing machine, the screen exploding in a fury of chainsaws, pool cues, and curling irons. We are dropping this episode on Christmas 2013, which is only fitting because every December 26th, I celebrate the anniversary of the first time I saw Black Shampoo with a group of friends. The first time was 25 years ago, way back in 1988, and one of those friends was Leon Chase. Leon, do you care to take us back to that fateful first viewing?
I think our favorite group pastime at that point was probably taking trips to the video stores and watching movies communally, and I think we always tried to find the most screwed up thing we could find. And if I may take credit, I think I actually found Black Shampoo at the Blockbuster. Is that right?
It was definitely at the Blockbuster there, Dick's and Eureka. Uh-huh. And I know I wasn't involved. I know that you and Steve kind of came over to me with the video box in hand. So I don't know if it was you or Steve Chesney that found it first, but definitely one of you, and definitely I was not one of them.
I like to imagine we had it under a large trench coat, but I probably made that part up.
Yes, I still have a VHS copy with that particular cover art of Jonathan looking very pensive with Brenda's leaning her head against his shoulder.
We brought that to Steve's house and we watched it. And I remember just, I mean, anyone who watches this movie, as soon as you get into the opening scene, you just know that you're in for a ride, so to speak. And I remember us, like, I think we probably, like, started calling people, like, halfway through that movie. I know we watched it and then instantly showed it to other people we knew, like, that night. Like, went to other people's houses and were like, you need to see the beginning of this movie. And that really kind of started what I consider, like, our own little cult following for that movie.
Yeah, if memory serves, it was a very snowy night and very dangerous to be out driving in. And I seem to remember kind of careening around Sibley Road going into Jeff Dunlap's subdivision and trying to take the film to him to show him this wonderful new thing that we had found.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was definitely some fishtailing in your car that night. I remember that.
My car did a lot of fishtailing in those days. Yeah, and ever since then, we've been trying to kind of spread the gospel of Black Shampoo. It's one of these, I think I compared it to Amway today, where whenever we get together with people, you always try to show it to new folks. So we've had many Black Shampoo parties over the years, even had a Black Shampoo party at one time, and always trying to get the virgins in the audience to expose them, so to speak, to Mr. Jonathan and the power of his hairdryer.
I always describe it to my friends as our own personal Rocky Horror.
We never stood up in front of the screen and acted it out, but we definitely had our own kind of characters and everything.
We all kind of took it upon ourselves to learn the lines. We all became responsible for certain characters. And, you know, it was also that, I'm going to sound like the old man now, but it was really that era of you had to have the tape. There was an object and there was a communal thing that happened about you were in a room and you had to put the tape in and you watched it with people. And that was a big part of it.
The story itself was rather compelling. And it was as one of, I can't remember whose father it was that came downstairs while we were watching it one time and started describing it as a softcore. But yeah, it encapsulates a lot of action, comedy, drama, a little bit of nookie going on.
Yes.
And really, it meant a lot for us. So Rob is kind of a stranger to this madness. Now, I know you'd seen Black Shampoo before, but what were your thoughts when you first saw it?
Well, the first time I saw it actually was right after I met you. I was working at the public radio station in Detroit. I talked to you about Impossible Funky, the Cashiers to Cinema collection. And at the then Burton Theater, you held a screening, book signing of your book and a screening of Black Shampoo, which included getting Graydon Clark on the phone. We could barely kind of hear him through the sound system there. But that was my first experience watching it. And I don't know how many people were in the audience that day, but it was great to see it because it was something that when I got your book and I met you at the station, I was just amazed at how much ink you gave it in your book. Like, this was just an obsessive thing. Like, you had all these interviews and all this various stuff in there. I was like, well, I guess I got to see this thing. I've got to go to this event so that I can understand what Black Shampoo is all about.
And do you now understand what it's all about?
Not on the personal level for me. I mean, I enjoy it. I enjoy it. It's a good film. It's fun to watch. But I understand that there's sort of another level on top of it. And the only film that I can think of that is similar for me with my friends was, and I've talked about it on the show, was the 13 viewings of Pulp Fiction in the theater during that summer, where we just got obsessive about it and we mapped it out and we had diagrams explaining how to, you know, put the film in chronological order. And like, we would just go see this thing. It was like a combination of obsession to go see it and the fact that my house didn't have air conditioning. So it was cheaper to just go hang out in the movie theater for 3 hours. And just keep watching Pulp Fiction over and over again that summer.
Sounds like you were kind of hanging around with the same wild crowd that I was when I was in high school.
Yes. The AV club, the movie geeks, exactly.
Yeah, we weren't really too much into like drinking and smoking and causing too much trouble. But yeah, definitely hanging out and watching movies was where it was at for us.
My high school years were basically consumed with being in a band, music, watching movies, and putting together, at least in my senior year, because I was so bored with classes, putting together an underground student newspaper. So that was basically it.
That was way cooler than us, really.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure if I discovered this movie at maybe 25 or 35, if I would have been quite as obsessive. So it's hard for me to separate the movie from the age we were when we saw it. And, you know, we're at that age, much like Rob's stories, like you want something to latch on to and you kind of make it your own. And you have a lot of time and energy to be obsessive about things.
Yeah. And this was what, like, we were both, I think, sophomores going into junior year or juniors going into senior year. 88 would have been, and we graduated in 90.
Yeah.
So this was winter of 88. So I guess it was juniors.
Yes. Yes.
And so, yeah, we had a lot of time on our hands at that point. Usually I'm pretty good when it comes to remembering where I watch things, especially movies and theaters. I can think of exactly, you know, oh, I was in Theater 2 at the AMC Southland when I saw this particular movie. And I can think, when I cast my mind back to Black Shampoo, I can think of so many houses that I've watched Black Shampoo in over the years. I mean, I can think of your house up in Ypsilanti. Yes. I can think of Chorky's house in East Lansing. I mean, so many people that just, you know, moved in and out of our lives mm-hmm. in high school and past that, just taking this tape everywhere we went and trying to spread the joy. What do you think it is? Why did we come back to this particular film? Out of all the movies that we watch, why this one? What was the magic?
For those who don't know me, I'm a bit of an apologist for a lot of exploitation movies. But this one in particular, I think that in general, the best exploitation movies are a combination of a really outrageous premise and outrageous scenarios, but also fairly decently made on a technical level. And really, for whatever else we want to laugh at with this movie, it's not horribly cut considering the time it was made and the budget they had. The cinematography, you're probably going to touch on that, but it's actually, there's some decent technical elements to it. So it's not like some movies where they're just awful and you love the trailer and you love that the movie exists, but it's very hard to actually sit through that entire movie. And I don't have that experience with this, even watching it for the 200th time or whatever yesterday. It moves. Yes, it's silly, and there's a lot of crazy lines, and some of the acting's kind of, you know, maybe not Oscar material, but for the most part, it's a good combination to me of ridiculous stuff, but also, like, fairly well executed. Like, it's still watchable.
The thing that I always think of when I think of Black Shampoo is just the amount of mirror shots that they had, which mm-hmm. usually you don't do in an exploitation film because you're always, you know, if you think about like Dolomite, I mean, the boom mic is a co-star in that film. And in this one, I don't really, you know, it is well made. I don't remember any kind of boom shots or anything going on. And there's a lot of mirror shots, which to me kind of speaks to the duality of Mr. Jonathan as both this Lothario and this lover guy, the loving machine and the killing machine, as it were. And definitely we have read a lot of stuff into this film throughout the years, you know, such as the dark flower that Mr. Wilson crushes up in his hand and just the power that he has over Brenda at that point in the film. But yeah, to your point, it definitely has its technical merits. I have to say that I think sometimes Richard, one of Mr. Jonathan's assistants, that he might not be the best actor in the entire world.
Her hair is a fright. You're right, Artie, baby. She should have came in here first.
And there are a few flub lines here and there. I know there's one from Skippy Lowe, Jonathan's other assistant, towards the beginning. And I think that Maddox might blow one of his lines at one point. But, you know, yeah, you're shooting this thing in 12 days. So it's definitely, it's better than it really has any right to be in a lot of ways.
Exactly. Like the things that you're talking about, I'm very sympathetic to what it took to make a low budget movie at the time. And having read the director's book, I know that they really did a lot of this stuff in one take. And I think a lot of what's awkward is stuff that if they had a bigger budget, you never would have seen. I'll tell you the other thing that I noticed rewatching it is even for the blaxploitation genre, which was already by nature more, quote, far out, than the mainstream stuff at the time. This movie's still really far out. I mean, it's the premise is this sex machine who apparently is such a good lover slash hairdresser that this bevy of women can't resist him. And, you know, I mean, they're obviously like there's a little bit of laughing going on in that first scene. Like, we're not expected to take this like completely serious as social commentary or anything. And it's not as sort of like rough and street as a lot of the other sort of blaxploitation stuff at the time.
Yeah, Mr. Jonathan is definitely not Mr. T from Trouble Man or Superfly or Shaft or anything. Right. He does have a sense of humor about himself. That whole line about having a little bit of experience with, you know, being 30 and all that, you know, kind of good building of the character, the way that, you know, Brenda's looking at him with a little bit of a wry grin on her face and everything. It knows what it is and it has a sense of humor about it. Though as you get into the film, for me, I really invest in the characters. So, Rob, you saw Shampoo, which I have never actually sat through all the way. Yeah. How does Black Shampoo compare to Shampoo? You would think of all films I would have seen Shampoo, but I never have been able to do it.
The one good thing about Shampoo is that it is Hal Ashby. I like Hal Ashby. I mean, if you're not familiar with who he is, you know, director of Being There and Harold and Maude, Last Detail, and Robert Downey Sr., when we had him on, talked about Hal Ashby, who was good friends with him. But Shampoo's kind of a low spot in his career for me. I mean, I think that at the time when it came out, it was probably hip and, you know, an important film. But I just don't think it holds up almost 40 years on. I would rather watch Black Shampoo any day compared to the Warren Beatty film. It's just very slow. It's not very funny. It's supposed to be. And basically the whole premise is Beatty wants to open the salon. He's a hairdresser. He's working for someone. He wants to open the salon. He's got like ladies all over the place. So there's that Lothario aspect. And it's sort of a social satire of the late 60s. But I think by 1975, it's kind of, I don't know. It just doesn't seem as interesting today as it maybe did then.
Yeah, I do appreciate that. Mr. Jonathan already owns his own business, mm-hmm. that he's a successful black businessman, you know, employing two very flamboyant homosexual, basically they're almost his partners in trade. When he has to go out and see Mrs. Simpson, he has no problem turning one of his other clients over to Richard. He knows that Richard's skill in hairdressing is impeccable, so no problem there. So it's nice to see that there is this relationship. I mean, sometimes I cringe at some of the, you know, more flamboyant gay stereotypes and everything, but then I have to remind myself that this is mid-70s, so we are going to have some of that baggage still going on.
Yeah, it is a little bit over the top. That was one thing at times that I put in my notes is the stereotype is cranked way up. Now, I understand that Skippy Lowe is a character unto himself. Like, he had this public access show in L.A. and was sort of a, you know, celebrity talk host. And he had a certain persona, which my understanding is he was the basis for Martin Short's Jiminy Glick character that he had that talk show. So there is this persona that he has. It's just at times it just felt a little too amped up compared to Jonathan, who is much more straight level. Like, he's not playing a real hip daddy-o, you know, blaxploitation character, which we have seen in other blaxploitation films.
Yeah, Jonathan is so laid back that at times it almost feels like he's asleep. Especially when he's with Mrs. Carruthers.
Mrs. Carruthers? Sally Carruthers?
And having just, you know, kind of serviced her, and she is moaning to beat the band, and it's, I believe it's Mrs. Carruthers that we're seeing in the opening credits who gets to have the first line of the film over the incredible music number that is going on, one of many incredible music pieces, which is also, I guess, one of the reasons why we go back to this film time and again. To see her, she's very passionate about what is happening to her, but really Jonathan doesn't even seem to be moving at that point. But perhaps that just kind of speaks to his prowess with the ladies.
Oh, Jonathan, feels so good. Oh, yes, oh, Jonathan.
Jonathan, oh, it feels so good.
We were discussing the same thing. I watched this with some friends yesterday, and you know, you want to believe that, yes, like, Jonathan's that good that he doesn't even have to move, and she's going wild. I'm also curious if maybe that had something to do with the rating system. You know, I know that there are, like, certain lines, like, I don't know, maybe it was like, yeah, we can show these people naked, but if he moves his butt too much, it gives us an X or something. Like, I'm curious if that was what was going on there, or if that was just Jonathan's choice or the actor's choice.
Too much genital thrusting, as it were.
Yes, that's the term I'm looking for.
For a lot of years, there were scenes that we didn't see in Black Shampoo, and that I eventually found through a Spanish bootleg of the film that included Jonathan kind of standing up and talking to Brenda at one point, Brenda, his receptionist, that he falls in love with eventually, kind of realizing, you know, that chasing all these women really wasn't for him, that he, you know, had this figure of true love right there in the salon the whole time, which is very convenient because she's only been there for 2 weeks, but they have a very moving, you know, love montage.
I should point out that this transformation actually happens in what I gauged to be about 2 hours at a botanical garden. And I believe Artie points out that she's been there 3 days. Or she says, I've only been here 3 days.
That's right. Just 3 days. Yes. Thank you.
You know, 3 days. Sometimes that's all you need.
3 days and a trip to the botanical gardens.
Yeah.
With the feeding of the geese and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Swans. Yes.
I met a couple that got married after 11 days.
It also reminds me of that montage in the Naked Gun film where it's Leslie Nielsen and Priscilla Presley, and they're, like, doing all of this stuff, tons of stuff. This montage goes on forever, and then at the end they're like, that's the best afternoon I've ever had. For a lot of years, we didn't see the entire thing because there's one part where what I could deem, I guess, is objectionable was Mrs. Simpson coming out and chasing her daughters away from Jonathan, Meg and Peg. When she mounts Jonathan to kind of show Meg and Peg up and let them know what a real woman is like, that scene always cut for us watching the U.S. version, apparently, or the old VHS version. And I don't know if that was an intentional cut, if that was just a really bad slice, like the film broke when Dimension transferred it over or whatever it was. But, you know, now in the VCI version and in the old Spanish bootleg that I ordered from Video Search of Miami way back in the late 90s, you could see Bush. But, you know, there was a little bit more to it, and there was a little bit extra with some dialogue between Jonathan and Brenda, which was not objectionable whatsoever. So I just think it might have been a bad cut both times.
I think it was a Bush issue, because between the mother and one of the daughters, there are a few seconds where in the course of their blocking, you see a little bit more than maybe the MPAA was ready to allow.
That could be.
It wasn't a time issue, was it? It didn't add all that much to the running time of the film.
We're talking seconds here. So maybe the dialogue with Jonathan and Brenda was like an extra minute at that. But yeah, the shot of Mrs. Simpson on top of Jonathan was like 5-6 seconds at the most. I mean, it was scant seconds, almost frames.
Well, remember, pubic hair causes crime.
Like I was saying, there were a lot of things that we kind of would pick up on in the film, you know, the mirror shots and stuff. One of them was how long the entrance was to Jonathan's salon, and just how often people would leave the salon and would take them minutes to actually exit the building. And I still find that either amusing, or I find it some sort of a very interesting, like, time device that they're introducing into the film. I'm not sure which it is.
Exactly. I like to imagine there's a very elaborate hall of mirrors out there.
So that the bad guys, when they come in, they can smash even more when they're destroying Jonathan's salon.
In keeping with the theme, yes, and it also explains that why Jonathan would be able to navigate it so much more quickly than the bad guys.
True.
I just came up with that.
I like it.
I was going to say that for production value in your mind, it's guarded by the Minotaur. So it's the labyrinth thing go from the old mythology, see?
Thinking about the duality thing that I touched on earlier, I guess that really plays very well into my favorite character, Freddy, and the magical water that he has that makes him say everything twice.
That's true. That's true.
Jonathan!
How you doing, buddy? How you doing, buddy?
Good.
Good to see you.
Thanks, yeah.
How you been doing? How you feel?
Oh, fine.
How's everything around the place?
Well, everything is coming along pretty good.
That's just great, really.
Hey, care for a drink of water?
Very good.
Uh-huh.
You were talking earlier, particularly about Jonathan as business owner and the gay characters. And having read Graydon Clark, the director's book, one of the more interesting things in terms of the thought that he did put into this was he mentioned that in your average blaxploitation film, the protagonist is usually a pimp or a drug dealer or someone trying to get out of the ghetto. And really, by the standards of the time, Jonathan's a very progressive character in the sense that he's got a business. He, you know, by all accounts is like, you know, a legitimate citizen. He's got a nice car. He's got, you know, women who love him. Like he's really kind of like living the dream. And I think that was really unusual for the time. And I also, you pointed out that he does befriend these gay guys and he has a relationship with them, which I got to say that, yeah, there are some terrible stereotypes and spoiler alert, there's one really, really horrible scene involving Artie. But I was telling my friends, like, I don't know if this is sad or great, but really, you know, barring like very few movies, this was probably like the most progressive treatment of gay guys at the time.
Yeah, I mean, in just a few weeks, we're going to be talking about Cruising. And, you know, that's 5 years after this. And there's, you know, some homophobia that plays on that really isn't in Black Shampoo. There's some, you know, some name calling and that kind of stuff going on, but it's always from the bad guys. You know, it's not like Jonathan is winking and just, you know, placating Artie and Richard or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one scene where they're trying to talk him into going to the Western style barbecue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's just like, okay, you know, and he smiles and stuff. But I think it's much more of these guys really care about me and they want to make sure that, you know, I get out of the salon. They can tell that I'm hurting because Brenda is with this dastardly Mr. Wilson at this point.
Mr. Wilson? I never heard of anybody by that name.
She seems content with her life, but, you know, okay, you know, I'll go with these guys. But he seems to be absolutely okay with them. It's Mr. Wilson and the chauffeur and, you know, the bad crew that comes in. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that abuse, literally, Artie and Richard.
Yes, I think it's important, again, giving the context and the time and all that, that Jonathan, the black stud hero, never sells those guys out. And likewise, if you recall, they go to the barbecue and there's this whole kind of running gag where there's another super queenie stereotype who's after Jonathan and they're actually keeping him away from him. So they really are kind of looking out for Jonathan. Like there's an actual relationship there. And I mean, you know, I may be like, it may be some wishful thinking, but it really is, like I said, for the time, like about the best you were going to get unless it's boys in the band or, you know, something that was, you know, really like out of the norm.
Right. Yeah. Most of the time, you know, a gay character in that role would be somebody to be made fun of or to be murdered, really, by the end of the film. And I would like to think that despite the bad things that happened to Artie, that he's okay. Yes. I mean, if Freddy can survive what he survives, I think that Artie should be able to come through with flying colors.
Artie may need some therapy before he returns to hairdressing full time, but
true.
For the most part, you're right. The gay guy doesn't die, which, sad to say, makes it progressive for the era.
Jonathan has a very big support network, because not only is there Artie and Richard, but there's, you know, Ruby, the another assistant there, and there's the manicurist. I mean, so he's got some good folks. And even, you know, when Jacqueline Cole comes in as the new receptionist, you know, she's kind of, you know, looking out for Jonathan as well when she's trying to, you know, get Brenda off the case because she doesn't know who Brenda is at that point. But, he's got some good people in his corner. I want to talk about how difficult it was. Rob, you mentioned how many folks that over the years we had tracked down and talked to and interviewed and everything about this film. And it was really difficult to do for a lot of years just because this was a non-SAG film and there were so many people that were using fake names throughout the movie. So like for years I thought that Sheldon Lee's real name was Salvatore Benissimo. And I thought that Jacqueline Cole, who is Graydon's wife or would be at the time or a little bit after the time, I thought her name was Edith Wheeler. So when she showed up in other films, I'm like, why is her name Jacqueline Cole and not Edith Wheeler? And I just, it like blew my mind, you know, about this. But I think we kind of got a tip that some fake names might have been used when Maddox's name showed up as Jack Mehoff.
No. Are you suggesting that wasn't his name?
Well, it did turn out years later that his real name was William Bonner. And you're going to love this one, Leon. He's actually in Orgy of the Dead. He's one of the guys that opens up Criswell's crypt at the beginning.
Of course he is. It's all coming together.
I thought you were going to say his real name is actually John Mehoff.
That's his brother, I believe.
Jacques, yes.
Yeah, and the thing, you know, I call Jonathan Knight, and really I think the only time that comes up is on the back of the VHS box. I don't think any other time does he have that name. And at first we were thinking maybe like the guy from New Kids on the Block named himself after this character, but then we found that might have been, of all the things, that might have been too much of a stretch.
And it is a running joke in the film because we only know him as Mr. Jonathan, and then I believe it's the daughters who say,
is your name Mr. Jonathan something or Mr. something Jonathan?
And that's never really answered in the movie.
He immediately distracts them by grabbing back his tools of the trade.
Which is funny because I remember when I saw this, and for a time after I would talk to you, I would just go, oh, Mr. Jonathan. You know, that was just like one of those quotable lines that I would just like interject into conversation and people would look at me funny.
The other thing that really puzzles me about this movie is why Mr. Wilson calls 841 on the phone, and who's voiced by Graydon Clark, and it took me years to figure that one out. But then he starts to explain what's going on with his situation. And then Mr. Wilson has to say, I don't want to talk about this over the telephone. It's like, well, then why did you call him in the first place?
He's a grumpy man.
He is. You would think that he would be much happier with Brenda back in his life.
Oh, speaking of Mr. Wilson, I can point out another thing that I noticed watching this for the 200th time or whatever is that I believe we found this in the action and adventure section at Blockbuster when we first watched it. And it really is like, aside from the reunion in the cabin, it really is like the first act is all sex. And then the second act is all action with very few exceptions.
It's a lot of action, especially the third act, which almost is one giant chase scene.
Past the same log over and over.
With that music just on repeat. Though it keeps you going, man.
Yes.
That music that's some of the best driving music that there is.
I have to say that that's another thing that I think really stands out. And I believe that Gerald Lee was recruited for this. It was his first soundtrack project, if I'm not mistaken. And it really...
Correct.
It really stands out. And I mean, I've actually noticed him on some other movies. I think did he do music for Satan's Cheerleaders, maybe?
Yep.
But enough where, you know, I recognize the name and kind of listened for it. But like, it really stood out. Like, you know, as someone who plays music once in a while, like I remember trying to like learn those bass lines on my guitar at the time, being like, wow, that's like, you know, that actually, the music really appealed to me. And I think it stands up. Like if you just, you know, really... You know, for all the humor that's going on and everything else, if you watch that opening scene, there's just like some great like vintage synthesizers and like some really amazing bass work. And whatever they were paying that guitar player with the wah pedal, it was not enough because that guy is just working overtime.
Well, yeah, and the music is so different from scene to scene. I mean, it really fits the action that's going on. I mean, the whole He's a Real Man song, and then you've got the chase music at the end. And then my favorite, though, I think is the Liquid Love scene, which is just so different from anything else that's in the movie, but it fits the action perfectly.
Yes.
And then, of course, the Can You Feel the Love song, which, you know, kind of comes back at one point when Brenda's having, you know, some difficult moments and stuff, deciding whether she's going to sleep with Jonathan, as if that's a decision for anybody.
Oh, it comes back several times. They got their money's worth out of that song.
And then from the music, it sort of takes another turn. And if it's still the same composer that wrote that as well, there's sort of that clowny kind of stuff when they're breaking up the salon.
Yeah, there's a soundtrack album out there, but it's a total bootleg. And I have to warn people not to waste their time with the soundtrack album, because if you want the soundtrack, do what I did when I was, you know, 18 years old or whatever, and record it right off of the, you know, the tape or now the DVD, because that's what they did. I mean, it's got the dialogue in it. It's got the exact same music. And then what's even stranger, though, is that all the songs are out of order. So it's like listening to the movie out of order. I guess it goes back to your Pulp Fiction thing, Rob. So yeah, if you listen to the soundtrack enough, you can kind of put together what order you think the songs actually should be
in. It's actually a way to sharpen your mind. It's a puzzle game that keeps you from getting Alzheimer's disease.
They did a total disservice. I wish there was a real soundtrack album to this that, you know, and that somebody would, you know, maybe Leon would write liner notes to it or something, because that would be very appropriate.
I'm going to take a break and play back a pair of interviews. The first is with Black Shampoo's cinematographer, Dean Cundey, and the second with the film's director, Graydon Clark.
Return of the Living Podcast.
Tell us about the masturbator.
Oh, actually, we do have a guy there that comes in at night, but our cleaning lady came out and goes, there's a gentleman masturbating in the men's locker room. And I walk in there, and sure enough, he's just there tugging war on himself.
So, like, ESPN?
Yeah,
like,
I don't think he wasn't even, like, facing the TV. He was just like,
I apologize on behalf of my uncle.
You know, the Dalai Lama's coming to Louisville. He'll be at the Yum Center.
Oh, wait, never mind. That guy molested children, didn't he? And that's why she killed him.
We go from the Dalai Lama the same breath to, oh, he molested children.
All right, that's a different
anybody
story.
Anybody that now comes in on that conversation is going to never think mind. We're talking about
the reason I thought it was funny is because I just got a message on my phone, but somebody invited me to an Ultimate Frisbee party down at Waterfront for next Sunday. And somebody's response was, I'd love to make it, but I'm going to see the Dalai Lama, and I don't know how late that gets out. I was like, how awesome of an excuse is that?
They're going to watch him.
Yeah, he's doing.
Is that like he's just
he's speaking.
He's gonna come in covered in Nutella
and sing to some bananas.
Now part of the 76th Street Network. Find them on iTunes.com and Stitcher.com by searching 76th Street Network. Also find them on Facebook.com as well as on Twitter at 245T Studios.
Hi, my name's Chris, and I've got Steven Seagal on the Old Dog and Bone. Steven.
Yes.
Have you ever desired to hear a weekly movie podcast hosted by two fellows from the northeast of England who run their little hands through the week's movie news and then cap it off with a review or two ranging from all sorts of genres, kung fu, anime, straight-to-video tomfoolery, bit of horror?
No.
Well, you're a dick who doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't even know why I'm asking you. I'm sure there's other people out there who have desired to hear such a thing, so if you're one of those lovely people, pop on over to wafufm.com. That's wafufm.com and check out the show. You can also find us on iTunes, TalkShoe, and Facebook at facebook.com/wafublog. Wafu FM, it's a podcast that's good and stuff. Shut up, Steven.
Hey, Iris, you know what we should do? We should try to get Fred Olin Ray on the show.
Why would he want to come on our show?
Hi, this is Fred Olin Ray, and you're listening to the Badasses, Boobs, and Body Count podcast.
Okay, what about Olaf Ittenbach, Germany's Splatter King?
That'd be great, but I doubt he speaks any English.
I'm Olaf Ittenbach, and you're listening to the Badasses, Boobs, and Body Count podcast.
What about the director of Blood-Sucking Freaks, Joel M. Reed?
Isn't he dead?
This is Joel M. Reed, and you're listening to Badass Boobs and Body Counts Podcast.
No, Iris, he's not. Hello, I'm Mike, host to the Badasses, Boobs, and Body Counts Podcast.
And I'm Iris, co-host of the Badasses, Boobs, and Body Counts Podcast.
Every week, and I, Iris, discuss lesser-known action, exploitation, and horror cult cinema.
Mike and I discuss films like The Black Godfather, The Beast That Killed Women, and Biozombie, to name just a few.
And every now and then, we get to speak with the people behind all the films we love to talk about.
Okay, how about this, Mike? Let's get Andy Sidaris on the show and talk girls, guns, and G-strings.
Yeah, RSD's actually really dead, but we did manage to talk to his wife, Arlene, way back in episode 20.
Well, I suppose that's the next best thing.
Yeah, I suppose so. So the Badasses, Boobs, and Body Counts podcast can be found on iTunes, on Stitcher Smart Radio, and on SoundCloud. Just search for the BB&BC podcast to start listening today. You can also visit the show's website at badassesboobsandbodycounts.com. Okay, Iris, did you keep track of the boob and body counts on the film we're discussing next week?
No, I thought you were doing that this week.
No, I've seen this, boy.
No, it was you. It was you.
Look, from now on, let's both do that.
Okay, that sounds good. Black shampoo.
Black shampoo, the motion picture. Straight up. Let's go. They ain't never seen how the black man move. Bitches on my stick, that's black bamboo. I be trying to eat like the Pac-Man dude. And a nigga stay clean, that's black shampoo. They ain't never seen how the black man move. Bitches on my stick, that's black bamboo. I be trying to eat like the Pac-Man dude. And a nigga stay clean, that's black shampoo.
Cool the motherfucker, put it down in the beat. Hand on the end of the room, hit the sand of the heat. Like, do they have a loop, put it down in the neat. Can I sip it in the brew, little pan in the wick. Can I drink it up, with a rest of fail. So we mix it up, little less of fail. Mommy twist it up, such a sex appeal. Time is ticking up, so what the heck, you deal. Peeping wavy hands to this. So the ladies in the room looking scandalous. Screaming flies, be the team, understand the click. Can't saucy up the goose, couple grand.
Tell me how you got involved with black shampoo.
Well, it was an interesting moment in my life, you might say. Black Shampoo was going to be shot by a friend of mine, and I was going to be the gaffer. And I had recently built a truck, a production van, called the Movie Van. I was introduced to the director, producer-director, Graydon Clark, and we started, and at the end of the first day, you know, I thought it had gone pretty well. The next morning, I walked under the, I think we were on a little stage, and Graydon came up to me and said, did I hear the news? I said, what news? Well, Michael, the cameraman, had been in a car accident last night, and he's okay, but he's in pain and so forth, and so he doesn't think he'll be able to finish the movie. And I said, oh, well, what are you going to do? He said, well, we've got to keep going. I'll have to see if I can find someone to replace him. But in the meantime, you know, I had done a couple of little short films and stuff. He said, why don't you just fill in? We'll do it today with you. And I said, oh, okay, that sounds good. So we worked for that day, myself becoming the director of photography. And the next morning I went to Graydon and said, did you find anybody? He said, well, let's just see how it goes. So at the end of the first week, where I had been, you know, shooting the whole time, and Graydon hadn't really looked for anyone, I was sitting on the dolly, and Graydon sat down next to me and said, you know, you're pretty good at this. Maybe you ought to think about doing this. And I said, oh, well, to tell you the truth, that's what I actually want to do, is be the director of photography. He said, oh, okay, well, that's great. Well, let's finish the movie. So it was one of those quirks of fate that led me to becoming the director of photography on Black Shampoo.
Now, you said you had done some short work before that. This was your first time as a full-fledged feature director of photography?
Yeah. I had done a little bit of work with a guy who had been a big-time editor on a lot of episodic television at Warner Brothers. He had made a career out of, later in his life, fixing movies. And it was the period of low-budget movies. You know, one of the things that sort of made it possible for me to get in was the fact that there was a market for B-movies, as they've become known. There were drive-in theaters still, and they needed product. And so it was possible to make, you know, these little kind of grindhouse movies, schlock movies, horror films about creatures and stuff. It was a case of, as a director, this guy would take movies that people would come to him and say, yeah, I've got this little movie, but it doesn't have a story, or the story falls apart. What should I do? And Herb Strock, would look at the movie and then write another scene, and he'd write something that explains this moment, and then he'd write a little car chase. And we would go out for like 3 days and shoot bits and pieces of a movie. And he would cut them in. And in general, it would improve the film. It gave me an opportunity to, sort of solve the problems of shooting feature films. But a couple days here, a couple days there. Black Shampoo was the first full feature that I had had the opportunity to do.
Tell me a little bit more about the movie van. What was that?
I had felt that for a couple of reasons. A lot of the low-budget films that I had been doing a little various things on, like a little makeup here and some special effects there, always suffered from not having enough equipment an assortment of good equipment and so forth, because the budget constraints meant that they had to go to rental houses and get smaller packages and stuff. So I said, well, there was this guy who had built the Cinemobile back in the, early 70s, late 60s. And they were used on some episodic television. I Spy was the famous one. So I said, well, that sounds perfect for low-budget films. So I got a large Dodge maxi van, which was relatively new at the time, and cut extra doors and put them on and compartmentalized it with plywood compartments, a very complex sort of egg crate thing where everything just fit together carefully. And in it, I had three Aeroflex 2C cameras and two blimps and an assortment of lenses and accessories for the cameras. And then two Nagra recorders and microphones for the sound department. I had about 30 different lights in it for, the electrical stuff. And then a small grip package. And it was just enough to sort of do the job. And in fact, do stuff a little better than was being done by other equipment packages. And then, I also felt that it would be a good calling card and an incentive to hire me to shoot movies. So it actually turned out to be that because I was able to, package it and get noticed and then, shoot a movie. And then, as is the case with a lot of, the film business, it's all networking, word of mouth, how successful was your last movie, and so forth. So the films that I worked on, I had the advantage of my own package of equipment, so I knew exactly what I had and how to use it. And also it gave me the opportunity to really learn the craft and art of cinematography.
Right, yeah, you're kind of a one-stop shop kind of guy, right?
Exactly, yeah, and I had a basic crew that I, provided that I worked with, so it was a package deal, which seemed to work out for various shows. I did 5 movies with Graydon. That was my introduction to John Carpenter, and did Halloween and other Carpenter movies and so forth.
Yeah, you're kind of Graydon's go-to guy for quite a while after Black Shampoo.
Yeah, it seemed to work out. And it's funny because he's retired in Vegas. So anytime I've been there in the last couple of years, I give him a call and we go out to lunch and reminisce about the old days.
Black Shampoo, it's not the most typical movie. I'm sure dealing with kind of those pickups that you were doing for the other guy that you were kind of used to this idea of exploitation films, and they were kind of de rigueur at the time. But what was your feelings about Black Shampoo?
It was an era of the blaxploitation movies, and it I don't know. I've always just sort of accepted the way the winds blow in the film industry. You know, they react to the audience, and the audience reacts to them. You know, so it's this oddly symbiotic relationship. And so I think that I had seen Shampoo, of course, and knew the culture of blaxploitation. And so I said, oh, well, all right, seems reasonable to me. And, you know, so you just worked on it. And you know, it's sort of like whenever I do a lecture or something at a film school, people always ask, you know, what's your advice for up-and-coming film students? And I can offer with a certain amount of authority, you know, my point of view, because that's exactly what I did. I was a film student who came up, as opposed to, you know, I have colleagues who joined the union as a loader and worked their way up through the studio system and never, you know, never really got into that sort of culture of filmmaking. And so I offer them the advice that I always sort of adhere to, which is take any job you can get. The corollary to that is, and you know, don't ask them, how much are you going to pay me? Just take the job, because it will lead somewhere. You know, 80% of the time, I think the jobs I did lead somewhere.
Yeah, you were doing just some amazing, I mean, well, your whole career has been amazing, but really looking back at those first few years, just the exploitation directors that you were dealing with, I mean, Don Edmonds and, you know, doing Ilsa Harem, Keeper of the Oil Sheik, and doing Bare Knuckles, and then even working with the Corman guys doing Rock and Roll High School. I mean, just great stuff.
You know my resume better than I do. I worked on those? Oh, good.
Apparently so.
Oh, okay.
At least you're credited with those.
Ah.
So hopefully you get the checks for them.
Yeah, I look back fondly, and a lot of people, you know, they'll read my resume and say, why do you have all these old movies here? Who ever heard of, you know, Satan's Cheerleaders? And I say, well, you know, there's nothing I'm really ashamed of that, you know, it's all a case of that's where I came from, that's how I learned, and I'm grateful for every single film I ever worked on for the opportunities that they furnished and the you know the training I was able to give myself and other people were to give me. So you know the little you know cheap exploitation films like Black Shampoo and Seven from Heaven or whatever, but they're all how we learned, I think, in those days, and they were great experiences because it was trial by fire, learning by fire, because you know you had to shoot it in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever, and all on location, and sometimes you had the luxury of a little stage or something. So you know it's how we learned in those days.
One thing that's interesting to me is you're a Michigan boy just like us, and wanted to ask you a little bit about growing up in Niles and sort of the early days for you.
Yeah, well, I think two of us were smart enough to leave Michigan, weren't we? Good, but go ahead.
So,
okay, you want to know about Niles, Michigan?
Yeah, I mean, I know that you're probably, when I think of Niles being a Michigander, there's you and then Tommy James and the Shondells came out of Niles. So just, you know, tell me about Niles in the early days.
Tommy James lived about six houses from me. Yeah, on the same street. I didn't know him. He's maybe, I don't know, 10 years younger than I. So I had left by the time he was a teenager, but I do know the house he lived in and the house that I lived in. But that Niles is more influenced by South Bend than any other city in Notre Dame in South Bend, because it's only about 15 minutes from, or even less, from the Indiana-Michigan border, and then South Bend is the major city 20 minutes away. And when I was a kid growing up, we would receive Chicago television. So even though it's Michigan, as a kid, I was not influenced by Detroit, which kind of was the straw that stirred all of Michigan. And Southwest Michigan is a very, very, very conservative area politically. In 1932, when Roosevelt ran the first time, they sent a Democrat to Congress as their representative from the county. He was there for 2 years, and the Republicans have won every election since 1934. And so it's very right-wing, very conservative. When I was a senior in high school, it was the Kennedy-Nixon election, 1960, and I became interested in politics and became a liberal Democrat. And when I left, and as I have lived these last 40 years or whatever it's been, I've become more liberal, more less conservative. I still go back and visit family back there, and we do our best not to talk about politics.
Now, when you're growing up as a liberal in Niles, did they make you wear a scarlet L on your lapel?
You know, they probably would have, but I left early enough that they didn't really know it. I got out of high school in 1961, went to college, played basketball for a year, and then had a minor accident. I was working at in the foundry of Clark Equipment Company and gashed my right hand rather badly. And, you know, I had to have stitches and so on and so forth. So like an idiot, I did not go back to college the next year because I was there on a basketball scholarship. And I probably could have continued, but I would have been, you know, a few months behind at least, because it happened toward the end of the summer. And working at Clark Equipment taught me one thing definitely, and that was I sure didn't want to work at a foundry.
Now, you gave quite a few people their start when it comes to speaking of jobs. Who are some of the people that you worked with for their first projects?
I did, yes, but it was certainly by accident. I had no way of knowing that this particular person was going to achieve some success or even continue in the business. And sometimes I would think, wow, this person is really good. More speaking of actors, talent in front of the camera. This person is really good. They're going to have a career. And more than once, they never worked again. And then other times I would say, well, you know, okay, the guy was all right, but nothing memorable about it. And they would end up having a terrific career. As far as people behind the camera, the one that comes immediately to mind, of course, is Dean Cundey. And that is Black Shampoo. I had done a picture called The Bad Bunch, which was quite successful. And I was involved in the distribution as well as the production of that picture. And I had sub-distributors around the country distributing The Bad Bunch for me, and they were doing really well with it. So they would call me and say, Graydon, what's your next film? What's your next film? And I wasn't sure, and they would say, listen, you have to do another blaxploitation picture. So I thought about it, and the Bad Bunch is about a group of young African-American guys who encounter a returning Vietnam vet, and there's a misunderstanding between them, and it's an action political film. But I didn't want to do another picture where the black lead...
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.